21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. 'Cause under love is a stronger emotion. She's got.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer. And who's running our board?
Noah Dankner.
Noah was there last hour, of course. Forgive me, Noah. We are going to continue this hour with our ongoing coverage of the fracking and related issues of the oil, gas, and coal industries in the United States. You know, I was doing a little research myself and went to a wonderful organization called Oil Change International to just look up the subsidies. And when I saw that we're all, as taxpayers, putting out $37.5 billion annually, that includes some international finance, to the fossil fuel industry. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But this hour, we're going to look at a particular issue in Maryland. And joining us to do that is we're going to be joined by Ted Glick, who is the National Campaign Coordinator for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and Paul Roberts, who is a citizen representative on the Governor's Commission on Fracking. The Chesapeake Climate Action Network, or CCAND, and we've had them on before, is the first grassroots nonprofit organization, founded in 2002 and dedicated exclusively to fighting global warming in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Their mission, according to their website, is to, quote, build and mobilize a powerful grassroots movement in this unique region that surrounds our nation's capital to call for state, national, and international policies that will put us on a path to climate stability, unquote. Paul Roberts, our other guest, is a winery owner and farmer in Garrett County, Maryland, where since 1996, he has operated Deep Creek Cellars with his wife, Nadine. Appointed by Governor O'Malley, he is the citizen representative on a special panel the governor established in 2011 to study whether shale gas development should be allowed in Maryland. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. So let me start with you, Ted, and CCAN's perspective, because you all have a lot of activity in various states. Why is fracking one of the issues CCAN is involved in?
Well, we've been aware of this and have been working on this for several years. We've seen what has happened in nearby states, in particular in Pennsylvania, where fracking has led to water being poisoned, essentially, on farms and properties where fracking wells are drilled down into the shale rock, where they pump down the water and the chemicals and the sand that leads to the whole process of getting the gas out of the shale rock. That water with the toxic chemicals migrates out. It affects water supplies. It's documented cases of many documented cases of that. That's one aspect of the whole fracking process that we saw from Pennsylvania in particular. But we also, as a group that has been focused on the issue of climate and the climate crisis and global warming, we knew that gas, natural gas, is one of the three fossil fuels, main fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas. We know that when you burn natural gas, that it creates carbon dioxide, puts carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere. But we also learned that methane, which is essentially what natural gas is, when that is released without being burned into the atmosphere, it's an extremely powerful greenhouse gas. The latest science says that it's about 85 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as far as its impacts on heating up the earth than carbon dioxide is. So for all those reasons, we did not want to see fracking expand. We did not want to see it come to Maryland, and we've been working to prevent that for several years.
Yeah, having read the reports, and there was a Sun Paper article recently by a California reporter who was commenting on the Stanford University study that, like so many, are sort of a little compromised sometimes politically. But it basically said in so many ways that there is contamination, but because Dick Cheney and cronies got fracking exempted from the Drinking Water Act and other environmental laws, when they say it's legal, it's not exactly legal. It's outside the law. So there's nobody actually overseeing and collecting the appropriate data other than the citizens and the states who are going to court against the fracking industry. And in I know Texas is trying to outlaw fracking.
There are a number of places, a number of localities, particularly in New York, but not just New York. There have been other places in Colorado, I'm sure elsewhere, where there have been local bans enacted, town councils, city governments, town governments have said, no, you can't do fracking here.
Well, you know, one of the extraordinary things when you look at the facts is not only is it not regulated, there is no potential remediation at all for the toxic garbage left in these wells, and they leave 45% to 50% of it, and as you pointed out, migrates into the aquifers and the wells that aren't the fracking wells, and that some of it's even radioactive.
Yeah, we're talking about natural gas that's been down there in the earth for basically millions of years. And yes, there is natural radioactivity in some of that gas. I know that in West Virginia, studies have shown that some of the gas that's been brought up out of the ground has been something like 100 times more toxic than the amount of radioactivity in the water that comes up is 100 times more toxic from the standpoint of radioactivity than water naturally.
Exactly. And the methane, of course, is out of this world. And I don't think people understand that we have 500,000 fracked wells already in this country, and 1.8 million Americans live by one. Let me go to Paul, who has been on this fracking commission, because, Paul, you have a really interesting perspective. Because in our state, they're talking about the Marcellus field and the Marcellus shale field. Talk to us a bit about this, where it is and what Governor Martin O'Malley is talking about doing.
Okay. Well, the Marcellus underlays a large part of Appalachia, running from up into New York all the way into southern West Virginia. And a big chunk of that, of course, is in the Appalachian part of Maryland and western Maryland, my county, Garrett County, and a little bit in Allegheny County, Maryland. And the fact is that Maryland really has a rather small reserve, approximately maybe 2 or 3 days of the national consumption, the entire reserve in Maryland at the current rate. And a fraction of the gas that is in the Marcellus in Pennsylvania and far smaller than New York or West Virginia as well. And it's important to understand that as much as we hear about shale gas, shale is still a minority producer, you might say, of natural gas in our country. The largest natural gas producer in the country is British Petroleum, in fact, in the Gulf of Mexico. And the problem for us is, as a nation, is that that supply will probably be exhausted by about 2025, something like that. And the portion of our natural gas consumption, which is around 22, 23 trillion cubic feet a year in the United States, more and more of that is going to have to come from other sources if we're going to maintain the sort of dependability that people have come to expect from natural gas. And that's going to become more and more difficult as we frack more and more wells, because what is happening in the unconventional shale plays, and not only in the Marcellus but also in the Southwest, is that those reserves are now being rapidly depleted. And in fact, the Marcellus reserve will probably peak most likely next year, perhaps later this year even, but most likely next year, and then we'll start to actually fall. So in order to keep up with the production that would be required for an export facility, say at Cove Point, which is such a big issue in our state now, you have to get on what has been called the drilling treadmill, you know, where you have to continually drill thousands of new wells in order to maintain just the kind of the floor of production that's required in order to run the entire infrastructure of this this system that's been developed. And, you know, we're all concerned about the environmental impacts of fracking today, and I would just say that, you know, there are estimates that in order to produce all of the gas in Pennsylvania, perhaps every fifth or sixth tree in the state forest of Pennsylvania will have to be knocked down. I mean, the environmental impacts that are looming here from shale gas development are quite phenomenal, and we're really not even aware of the impacts that are likely to be coming at us. And in Maryland, a lot of that impact is going to be happening in the suburban and urban areas of the state where the pipelines are going to be built from the existing gas fields in Pennsylvania in particular.
So the Virginia company called Dominion Resources, they're the ones that want to build this massive export facility, let alone on the Chesapeake Bay in southern Maryland. And we're talking about they want, and our governor is promoting at this point, exporting fracked natural gas to Asia. So, I mean, obviously, it begs the question of it's going to incentivize, of course, more fracking around the region, and it could trigger, as you all point out, more planet heating pollution. But one of the topics rarely discussed by, certainly you don't hear the local press talk about it, is the trillions of gallons of water that are used from local aquifers and local wells. We're talking about good water that they use then to do the fracking, and each well can be fracked like 14 to 18 times. So we're talking about trillions of gallons of water that are being wasted just to frack the well, and then the billions and billions of gallons that get polluted, or trillions maybe, who knows, because nobody's measuring. Nobody knows how to measure because we have these toxic soups that they also have under trade secret law, so you don't even know what poisons they're putting in. And what poisons we know are going in are all carcinogens. You know, they cause birth defects. People who live near these wells will tell you they have constant nosebleeds, migraine headaches, asthma. Of course, their property values plummet. Let's come back to you, Ted, about some of the issues of the impact on the water supply.
On what? Well, you're right that one of the big issues with fracking is the tremendous amount of water that needs to be used in the process of getting the gas out. My understanding is that it's at least 1 million gallons that is used per...
Yeah, four to 8 million, I've read in some reports, per well.
That's right, and it could be more than that. So
then exactly. Then times 18 per well.
You know, you think about California and what's happening right now with the drought out in California. Well, there's been an effort underway for the last couple of years within some intensity to really expand fracking in a major way to some of the shale and also oil. There's fracking of oil, too, kind of the same process using getting out oil. And think about the drought and what's taking place out there. I mean, there are definitely parts of the country where, you know, it doesn't make sense to believe that it's going to be possible to keep local economies going, like rural economies, any economies going, and under conditions of heat stress and drought, to also then be engaging in the amount of fracking that is being projected. So that's a big issue that actually is not talked about very much.
Well, and I did read a study.
A lot of parts of the country.
Yeah, and I did read a recent study, finally, by some geologists of the concern that this extraction of all the gas and oil from under the surface of the earth is weakening the actual fabric of the earth, and we're seeing, you know, these sinkholes, we're seeing earthquakes, we're seeing peculiar heatings and eruptions that you wouldn't normally. Let me come back to you, Paul. You are a citizen representative on Governor O'Malley. That's the governor of Maryland, where this show broadcasts from and where we live. So I have particular interest in this issue. Talk to us a bit about what you all were assigned to do and how that has come along.
Well, the the governor put in place this unofficial moratorium in the summer of 2011 after a group of citizens, including myself and some others here in Garrett County, really began challenging the state of Maryland in the late part of 2010 and early 2011 because the state was very close to beginning fracking. Many people probably are not aware, but I think we were probably 90 days away from taking the Pennsylvania route on this, which was to begin the development of the industry without proper regulations in place. And really, a group of citizens here in my county essentially stood up and insisted that the state not go forward. And that led to, especially in conjunction with working with a fabulous state delegate named Heather Mazur, a gubernatorial candidate this year, a progressive Democrat in the party.
Yeah, wonderful woman.
Yes. And we really worked with her to put in place the conditions that led to the moratorium. And the governor's executive order just says, I mean, it's a long, you know, legal document that just says that we're going to study this and determine whether or not there are unacceptable risks associated with the technology. And the commission's final report, I believe it's the third and final report, is due out late this year, probably in November or December of this year. And we've done a tremendous amount of work. The state is writing new regulations that would deal with the industry. When we got involved in this in 11, the regulations had not been updated since 1993, did not even mention hydraulic fracturing in the regulations, for instance. And, you know, many in the state, including our elected representatives here in our county in Western Maryland, were content with Maryland having a regulatory code that was simply not up to the task. And this is really the work of citizens insisting on something better that's led to the position that we're in now, which is, you know, I don't personally see the evidence that fracking can be effectively regulated by government anywhere. There are such significant impacts that are occurring in every place where the industry is operating that I'm very skeptical that we can effectively regulate it. Any government can. But Maryland has at least taken a cautious approach, and I think if the industry does go forward in the state, and we're quite a distance away from that being possible now still, there's a lot more work that needs to be done, but I think if it does go forward in the state, we will have, you know, a very strong regulatory code in place.
We'll come back to some thoughts on that I have and that maybe our guest Ted does. If you're just joining us, I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Our guests this hour are Ted Glick, who's National Campaign Coordinator for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. You can find them at ChesapeakeClimate.org. And also joined by Paul Roberts, who is a citizen representative on the Governor's Commission on Fracking and is also a winery owner in Garrett County of Deep Creek Cellars.
Hi, I'm Dr. Martin Blank from Columbia University, and I'm the author of Overpowered, What Science Tells Us About Cell Phones and Other Wi-Fi Age Devices. And you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zahara Hieronymus.
Now that's a book everybody should buy, Overpowered. He was our guest recently, and if you think your cell phone isn't doing anything to your biology, think again. You know, there was actually an EPA commissioner, I don't remember the gentleman's name, I apologize, but back in 2008, he recommended listing cell phones as carcinogens. They take a playbook from the tobacco industry, as has the GMO community, as has the fossil fuel industry. You know, without the billions of dollars of subsidies that the shale gas industry gets, they couldn't frack our wells in our states. They couldn't pollute our aquifers and our air. They couldn't go around doing what they're doing, and we'd have to put in Can you believe it? Sustainable energies. We'd have to put billions of dollars into solar and geothermal and wind and things that we know will be next century's energy systems. Or like I mentioned, the car that is now going to run in Europe on a saltwater fuel cell. It's also obvious to those of us that want these changes, but the people who don't want the changes, you know who they are. It's the status quo, multinational corporations who are subsidized by the governments of the world, primarily by the United States government. You know, there have been attempts in our own Congress over the last number of years to get rid of state and fuel, so to speak, to get rid of the relationship between Congress and the fossil fuel industry. And just a little piece of information, then we'll come back to our guest on the issue in Maryland. 2011 to 2012, the oil, gas, and coal companies spent $329 million in campaign finance contributions and lobbying expenditures and received, guess what they got in return for all that effort? $33 billion in federal subsidies over the same 2 years. That's more than a 10,000% return on investment. If you want to read some of this stuff, you can go online to a wonderful organization called Oil Change International and just Google them and you'll it's extraordinary. It really just puts it all in place. As I always said when I was a daily investigator, follow the money. So if you've just joined us, we're going to follow the money and looking at the shale gas development here in Maryland and the Cove Point export facility that our governor in his potentially presidential run is promoting. Our guests, if you've just joined us, are Ted Glick, who is the Chesapeake Climate Action Network coordinator from and you can find them online at ChesapeakeClimate.org, and Paul Roberts, who has operated Deep Creek Cellars, a winery, since 1996, and he was appointed by Governor O'Malley to be the citizen representative on a special panel since 2011. So we left before the break, gentlemen, talking about, Paul, you had mentioned that the commission will come out with its report and what is commonly called in every industry best practices, that Maryland will institute best practices to regulate the field. And I personally don't think it can be regulated because I think the elements of it are A, too unknown. Let's start with the chemical bruise that they inject into the well. It's protected by trade secret status.
Well, yeah, there's certainly a lot of controversy about the trade secret issue and as it relates to hydraulic fracturing, the fluids that are used in it. And that's a very important issue, and there are tremendous side effects that are going on in the fracking regions of Appalachia now, especially as relates to air pollution. There's an awful lot of hydrocarbons that are being put into the air around fracking sites, and then of course you also have the spurious methane that's being released into the air, and then you know occasionally you have an explosion or two as well. You know, the industry really doesn't seem to be able to go a quarter each year without some sort of a you know cataclysmic explosion somewhere in Appalachia.
Well, and I read a false Sun paper report saying there have been no records of polluted wells. Well, that's just either an outright lie or a totally lazy reporter, because all you have to do is find there are at least 1,000 private wells that are on record as having been polluted. And that's just the ones of people who go public, because people are afraid to notify the officials that their wells are polluted because then they can't sell their property.
Well, just last week, the state of Pennsylvania released its own official report citing 243 instances of wells being contaminated, primarily through methane contamination. That is, high levels of methane in the water column in people's drinking water, leading to instances where you've actually had explosions in homes because of that.
Yeah, that beautiful film Gasland shows people turning on their tap and it just looking like a propane butane torch.
Right. I mean, let's face it, those instances so far are not commonplace.
No, thankfully.
But there are studies, very, very solid studies in Pennsylvania suggesting that in the first year alone, somewhere around between 8 and 9% of the wells that are drilled suffer a casing failure, Not every casing failure leads to an environmental catastrophe, obviously, but the point is, in the Pennsylvania case, where 243 wells were shown to be compromised, I know activists in that state who say that it could be, you know, five or six times that much. And the state, in fact, some of those cases involve multiple wells. You know, one case I'm particularly aware of, there were 17 wells that are counted as one incident. So there's an awful lot of impacts that are occurring to people as we speak. There is in Butler County, Pennsylvania, there's an entire rural community that relies on church charity for drinking water today. So these are real things that are happening in the other states around us, and you know, it's as I said before, I just don't see the evidence that this can be done safely, but Maryland is making every attempt to develop a regulatory code to try to do it safely, it seems like. And the governor seems determined by all outward appearances to be pushing forward.
And from my vantage point, having been in the ecological movement my entire lifetime, this is called double talk. When a governor says, I'm looking out for the citizens' welfare, their health, and well-being, and then proceeds to underwrite and backroom deal cozy political maneuvering with, you know, subsidized industries who have backroom dealed these politicians, and then tells us it can be safe when there's absolutely no way on earth any human being has come up with a way to make shale fracturing safe. Not for now, not for the future, and not for the ever, because the way and what they are doing is not healthful.
Well, I know, you know, the governor just this summer, in May of this year, held a presidential fundraiser while we're determining whether or not to allow shale gas development in Maryland. He held a fundraiser at the American Natural Gas headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Of course. He's like all the other governors, Republicans and Democrats alike. This is what drove me to become a libertarian, because they're all in bed with the same corrupt corporate policy. And, you know, and I've called it by a very legal term and asked some of these big national groups to do the same thing, that all of these actions are, I would call, reckless endangerment. They know the health impact on the population. They know the ecosystem, the ecological nefarious impact that it has. They know it's destroying our drinking water and our groundwater and our aquifer water. And yet they'll go ahead and do it because they're in the back pocket of these corporations. This is criminal behavior from my vantage point.
Well, I mean, I hear what you're saying, Zoe, and that there's certainly a very strong, you know, body of opinion to support the point of view you've just expressed. The health impacts of fracking are really just being developed. I think those are really there's a tremendous amount of research going on about this around the United States. And I think that in the months and years here in the short term coming forward, we're going to see a lot more important information about the health impact.
But, you know, it reminds me, like I mentioned at the start of this hour, it reminds me very much of the GMO phenomena, genetically modified foods, and how it's marching forward in this country, even though common sense nations around the world have outlawed it in their own, refused to take our GMO food because they see the danger it's now posed to the insect population, to the organic food, to the seed supply, to human health, to the well-being of the world. And it doesn't even respond to consciousness, and that's a whole nother discussion. But it's the same kind of thing. It's subsidized. The genetically modified foods would not exist without government subsidies. All of this shale fracking would not exist without the government subsidies. So why not put this billions of dollars, and I'll turn to you, Ted, because you all are focused on intelligent, forward-moving energy mission, which are sustainable technologies. Talk to us about, you know, 75% of the country, if not more, would want us, if we could, to have residential solar panels, or it's even more than that, like 85% of all Americans want us to move out of the old fossil fuel industry, which is basically now part of the political machine and not necessary.
That's absolutely true. Polls show and have for years that you know, basically by the percenters that you said, roughly three quarters of all Americans, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever you may be politically, people see that wind and solar renewables are the future in terms of energy sources. And they really have to be. One of the pieces of good news amidst all the bad news in terms of energy policy and energy practice in the United States is the fact that wind energy and solar energy have dropped in prices, and the technology has advanced, and as a result, those are growing rapidly in terms of energy sources in the United States and also very much in the world. I believe the figure is that renewables have tripled there's been a 100% increase in the amount of renewable energy, you know, put in place in the United States over the last 3 years. Although there are some issues with wind energy because of tax credits that are expiring soon, that have affected the installation of wind energy. Certainly for solar, solar is really taking off. It's still very small percentage-wise in the United States, but with the drop in prices in particular, the technology that is so much cleaner than the fossil fuels, solar as well as the wind and geothermal technologies, they definitely are becoming much more practical and are growing. So that's a very positive thing.
I haven't looked up the figures on what kind of investment there is by state or federal government. I'm going to have to do that, but I know it's puny in comparison to the trillions of dollars, literally, here and overseas, whether it's through our military defense of oil track or development of shale fracking in this country. The subsidies are nothing. And if we would change, like Germany has and Japan is and some other countries, the Scandinavian countries, we would be able to move ourselves so much more quickly out of this energy emergency and stop killing ourselves and our future. That's, you know, to me, it's just, it defies human reason and the heart of the human that we could so recklessly destroy our environment for short-term profit.
Yeah, I believe that the figure is something like either 6 or 7 to 1 in terms of subsidies for fossil fuels compared to subsidies for renewables, which, you know, that's just wrong.
It's insane.
Wrong. I mean, the situation that we're in terms of the acceleration, really, of the heating up of the Earth, of the global warming process. Just in the last month, month and a half, I think you mentioned this earlier, there are these huge, like, sinkholes, huge sinkholes that have opened up in parts of the permafrost in, you know, the northern northern latitudes that scientists believe are one of the latest signs of, again, this acceleration of the process of impacts on the Earth. Another one of the impacts is the acceleration of the melting of Greenland, you know, the ice that's on land on Greenland. I believe the figures are that over the last maybe 5 years that there's been something like a doubling of the rate of increase of melting of this of the huge ice sheet on Greenland. West Antarctica, with the recent information that's come out, that we're pretty much, you know, there's not much we can do, really, to prevent so much of the West Antarctica ice sheet eventually melting that the sea level will go up. I believe the figure is 10 or 11 feet. That's over a period of centuries, most likely. We'll have to see.
Yeah, so much is unknown, exactly.
It's one thing after the other, and yet we continue down, as you're saying, down these same paths. I mean, there's a term that a lot of activists in climate are using. It's extreme energy, that we're going after these extreme energy sources.
Yes.
You know, the fracking, the tar sands, the oil and the gas up in the Arctic region with the melting of the Arctic sea ice. Now we're going to get the oil and the gas down there. It doesn't make any sense if we really were about serving the needs of the people, of all life forms on the planet, and being concerned about our children and our grandchildren's future. You're absolutely right.
You know, and I remember doing a study once when during the Clinton administration showing how his behavior and some others were sociopathic. And it's really true. Our government is a sociopath. They knowingly do things that harm others with the ability to disassociate. When shown in the face of information of the harm that they do, they continue to do it. I mean, these are all sociopathic behavior. So we really have a sociopathic political system which sees acceptable risk as totally appropriate to their behavior, and that regardless of what the citizens want, now that the Supreme Court has borne the corporation as the new kid in town, the citizens really need to stand up. And that's what I'd like to come to next before we take our last break. Do we need to take a break? We'll take a break, and then what I want to come back is I want to go straight on back to where we began, which is this Dominion Resources out of Virginia wanting to build this massive export facility on the Chesapeake Bay in southern Maryland to export fracked natural gas to Asia. And our governor means it, and he is going to use this money from the oil and gas corporations for his business, as you heard, fundraising while he's talking out of the other side of his face about keeping us safe in Maryland from fracking. I said a long time ago, it's a done deal. I used to cover this stuff. Follow the money.
Hello, I'm John Perkins, author of many books, including Confessions of an Economic Hitman, www.johnperkins.org, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zohara Hieronymus, one of my very favorite people and a person who's spreading light around the world, who's really opening us up to the new changes in consciousness that we're experiencing at this incredible time in human history. My hat's off to Dr. Zohara Hieronymus and all that she's doing. She not only represents freedom of the press, but she also represents this new wave of waking up to new consciousness that's going to create a sustainable, just, peaceful world that's thriving for all sentient beings. Keep listening.
Amen, Brother John. Won't it be the day? May we all live to see it. And we are all part of this change, and we often talk about that. So while the old status quo corporations and the old way of doing the world of divide and conquer passes out of, favor, as our friend, the dear late Chris Bird, used to say, yeah, you just got to wait for the old guard to die. It's like very simple. I remember talking to Jean Kirkpatrick once about the cycles that it takes for things to change from one world paradigm to another. And she said, 60 years. Well, we don't have 60 years to wait. So our guest, if you're just joining us, is our Ted Glick, who's National Campaign Coordinator for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. You can find them at ChesapeakeClimate.org. And Paul Roberts, who is a citizen representative on the Governor's Commission on Fracking here in Maryland. Ted, for people who are interested in making sure that this Cove Point is not developed in southern Maryland, and Paul and I talked a little off air about one of the problems of the situation and why there's not a lot of grassroots yelling and moving yet is because it's in a rural area. But talk to us a bit about how CCAN and others are working to stop Cove Point project from even coming into manifestation.
Well, we've been organizing on this issue really for about a year now. There was a tour that we did back in November of 2013 where we went all around the state, 9 different places over the course of about 3.5-week period, and it's kind of like Paul Revere saying, hey, watch, this thing is coming and we have to get organized and fight it. And that did happen. There has been a lot of activity that has taken place. Actually, there were over 150,000 individual comments that were submitted to the federal agency that needs to make the decision on this, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. That happened back in May and June, when there was a month when people had to respond to a what was called an environmental assessment that was put together by FERC on this proposal of Dominion. And there was a demonstration, 1,000 or more people, that took place in the middle of July, very hot day in the middle of July, demonstrating, marching on FERC. There's been all kinds of phone-ins and, you know, email campaigns, social media. So there has been a fair amount of activity, and at the same time, and this is unfortunately going to probably be very critical, we've had lawyers who have been working for all through this whole time period, basically getting prepared for what we expect will be necessary, which is to take legal action to sue this agency, FERC, because their history is a history of doing essentially what the gas industry wants them to do.
Of course.
The figure is something literally like 98% of all proposals that come to FERC from the gas industry for interstate pipelines or for import terminals.
We call that one fat fox.
they're a rubber stamp, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's FERC's history. So, you know, that's the reality. That's why we're prepared to sue them, but we're also prepared to keep up the heat on them. There are plans underway right now for actions coming up in a few weeks to keep the heat on FERC and to keep the spotlight on them. You know, it's rough with FERC, I have to say. I mean, there are, in a lot of the efforts that our group is involved with, there are some angles that you have. You have, like, local hearings that need to take place. You have local bodies, you know, commissioners, town councils, whatever they may be, where you have the possibility of actually influencing the human beings who have to make the decisions to approve a particular project. Or on a state level, same thing. But with this FERC, with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they're appointed by the president. The commissioners, the five commissioners who run it, they're appointed by presidents for I believe it's 4-5 year terms. I think it is. And once they're appointed, and once they've been approved by the Senate, then they're, you know, an independent agency. That's what they call themselves. I've actually had meetings with the top the heads of FERC, one John Wellinghoff last year, and then the one Cheryl LaFleur this year, and they talk about how they're independent, an independent agency that makes its own decisions and so on. And they get, and believe it or not, their financing base is the natural gas industry. They get their money from the gas industry that has to pay them for the work that they do. So they're essentially, I mean, you could call them partners in crime,
of
by
course,
and large, in terms of what they are doing right now, for sure. I mean, FERC also certainly has very important responsibilities in terms of maintaining upgrading very much now, which is a necessity, upgrading the grid, the electrical grid for the United States, trying to keep it safe and so on. Those are obviously important functions. But when it comes to their role in relationship to the gas industry, the experience of people all around the country is, again, they're a rubber stamp for the gas industry. So it's a big fight that we have on our hands to try to prevent this Cove Point project from going forward. And, you know, as we said, in addition to the spotlight that we put on them, the pressure we brought on them, the very sound arguments from a factual standpoint that we've brought to bear to them, that we've filed with them, we also have the lawyers ready to go, and we think that's going to unfortunately be necessary.
Earth Justice, who I've interviewed, has, you know, offices all over, and they work with a lot of groups like yours and other animal rights groups, et cetera. And one of the things I've noticed in the last 5 years of the coverage I've done all these decades is that the winds are in court, in the court of public opinion, and public will, often against the local legislatures, but most often legislators now coming together with citizens against the corporations. And then the corporations, regardless of which issue we're talking about, whether it's fracking or something else, then try to deny the citizens and the legislators their right to sovereign autonomy. It's extraordinary what's happening in our country with the corporate power using the courts to shut down legislative decision-making, representative lawmaking. I mean, this is terrorist behavior. People don't like the words I use. They go, oh, Zoe, that's extreme. Well, I used to talk about extreme politics, and as you pointed out, people are talking about extreme energy. But I want to come back to the Cove Point. And, Paul, you've been on this commission. Does the commission make recommendations beyond this notion of best practice for regulatory? I think it's a mythology that you can regulate something that's inherently toxic, inherently hazardous, inherently bad for the environment and human health. You don't regulate things that are destructive. You get rid of them. You transform it into something positive. But talk to us more about Cove Point and why this is part of our governor's potential campaigning for president.
Well, the governor, you know, the governor's set to run for president, and he will need to raise a lot of money in the energy sector. And so he's picking his next steps very cautiously in Maryland. And the important thing that Ted mentioned about Cove Point is to try to understand what the connection with Cove Point is to fracking in Maryland, since, you know, we're living in Maryland and we're talking about state government in Maryland and public officials in Maryland. And the concern is that if Cove Point goes forward, the ultimate goal of the industry is to create an export market for American fracked gas. And the reason they want to do that is because gas is much more valuable in most the rest of the world than it is in the United States. It sells for a higher price. Their goal is to get that gas being produced in the United States. And understand that when this industry began in the eastern U.S. in about 2005, 2006, they were talking about energy independence for Americans. And now we have the specter of the industry working 24/7 to create an export market for the gas. So something is, we've had an evolution here of the talking points by the industry, and now we're in a situation where, they're trying to get this gas sold abroad. And the connection for Maryland is, does anyone really think that Cove Point is going to be developed on Chesapeake Bay in Calvert County, and that isn't going to lead to gas being sought and fracked in our own state? You know, it's going to drive the price of the product up internationally. The point is to reach international levels with the price. That's going to create more pressure to develop gas reserves in parts of the country, including Western Maryland, where right now it's simply not cost effective to put the infrastructure in place to drill for the gas. But if the price goes up because of Cove Point, everyone who follows this closely feels that that would create a market conditions that would make it profitable for the industry to develop in Maryland.
Well, look, once the reports come out, we're going to do a follow-up show, all right? And we'll look at what the commission actually recommends, and then we'll talk some more about what we in Maryland and everybody else in our listening audience where they live can do to try to move the smarter technology, sustainable ones forward. Thank you all for being with us. Go to ChesapeakeClimate.org and also visit Deep Creek Cellars in Garrett County.
Talk around the clock
and breaking news now
on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio 1, Bill Fitka.